announcing your host, Jody Levin-Epstein.
Thank you, and welcome, everyone, to the Center for Law and Social Policy's ongoing series of audio conferences on budget developments and related issues in an array of social service programs. Our focus today is child support, and my guest is Vicki Turetsky of the Center for Law and Social Policy. Hey, Vicki.
Hi, Jody. How are you?
I'm great. I also want to say hello to a couple of folks in our audience. In New York State, the Division of the Budget has a staff of at least two or three people sitting around the phone today. Hello. And in Wisconsin, the Department of Workforce Development has about at least 10 people sitting around a conference table listening in today. So welcome, everybody. I'm going to jump right into the substance of this audio conference, Vicki, because we have just a ton of ground to cover. Could you just help us get a little lay of the land about the child support program and how it what the key issues are out of the budget bill?
Well, there were big changes to the child support program made by the bill, and there are three types of changes. First, a set of funding cuts, including a cut to matching incentive payments and a parental fee. There are changes to pass-through and distribution rules, and there are various program changes that are generally seen as helpful, although they will cost states money to implement.
We're going to go deeply into each of those. For those of you who found some of those words a little Greek, we'll have a chance to get those all explained. But, Vicki, what I'd like you to do before you do get into those details is to give your bottom line on the importance of the child support program for families. You've been a child support advocate for many, many years. What's big about the child support program? What's important to families?
Well, 36% of poor families and half of near-poor families receive child support. So it's a big part of families' budgets. For poor families receiving child support, a third of the family budget comes from child support. In addition, child support reduces public assistance use. It helps families hold jobs longer. The research shows that child support reduces divorce rates and non-marital birth rates. And it's linked to better educational outcomes for children, probably because it represents the fact that parents are involved. A dollar of child support has been found over and over again to be more valuable to children than other forms of income.
Turning to the cuts, you mentioned two direct ones and a fee that shifts costs to families. What are the two direct cuts?
The largest cut is a prohibition on states drawing down federal matching funds on performance incentive payments. There also is a cut in the matching rate to pay for genetic testing to establish paternity.
Taking the incentive match cut first, it's the biggest, so let's start there. In order to understand it in context, can you give us a quick primer on child support financing? Not too intimidating one. Keep going.
You ask a lot.
Yes, yes, yes.
The child support program is an interstate program. It's highly regulated and coordinated across the states to enforce child support across state lines. The federal government pays the lion's share of costs because of its interstate nature. The federal government pays 75% of costs, and that includes two main funding streams, a 66% federal matching fund and performance-based funding called incentive payments.
Okay, so now I'm going to give you a chance to help us all understand some of these vocabulary words. Fill us in on what you're meaning when you talk about performance-based funding.
Well, child support is one of the few social services programs that gets true performance-based funding. There are five audited performance measures that states must meet, and if they don't meet a minimum performance level, they receive a penalty. Those penalties are taken against TANF funds. In addition, states that perform well receive incentive payments from the federal government, and the better a state does, the higher that the incentive payment. Those funds are capped by statute and divided among the states according to their relative ranking. Until the funding cut is implemented, one-fourth of all child support funds are tied to program performance. In other words, this is the big source of funding for the child support programs. States are required to take these performance funds, these incentive funds, and reinvest them in core child support enforcement activities, and then they've been permitted to draw down the 66% federal matching funds when they spend that money.
So when we're talking about performance incentive payments, there's two parts to it. There's the performance incentive itself, and then there's a federal match on top of that?
That's right.
Why?
The funding was set up this way because child support programs were drastically underfunded and understaffed in the early 90s. There were 2,000 child support cases per worker in many states. And the public got exactly what it paid for. The program barely worked. Year after year, the collection rate stayed flat, 18%, 19%. In other words, 80% of families were not getting child support in those days, just 10 years ago. Members of Congress got many, many complaints from constituents and made it a priority to make the program work. Congress saw the incentive match as a way to create a pool of funds to make program improvements and increase the collection rates. At the same time that states could draw down on this substantial pool of funds, states were held to strict performance measures and penalized if they didn't perform. So it's a true carrots and sticks kind of funding system.
So what measures tell us whether it worked or didn't work?
There's a measure for the rate of establishing paternity, the father-child relationship. There's a measure for the percentage of cases with support orders. That's the legal obligation to pay child support. There are a couple of measures measuring how effective the child support program is in collecting child support on time and collecting child support back payments that are overdue. And finally, there's a cost-effectiveness ratio.
And all of these have improved?
All of them have improved. In fact, they've improved dramatically. The child support collection rate has more than doubled since the system was put into effect.
And that was about a decade ago, did you say?
Well, a decade ago, the collection rate was 18-19%. The incentive system was put into place in 1998. And the big improvements in the program come from a variety of reasons, but they have all taken off since the incentive system went into effect. A big piece of that improved performance has been improved funding.
But during the budget bill debate, the congressional proponents of the child support cuts charged that it was the incentive match itself, which they argued was an unintended loophole in the child support laws, and that states were taking advantage of the federal government. Is that a fair description? Was that right?
No, it's not a fair description. The incentive match was known and endorsed by Congress as a way to create a substantial pool of funds. In 2003, for example, the Department of Health and Human Services sent a report to Congress assessing the effectiveness of the new performance-based system, and that report said clearly that the incentive funds take on added importance because they are matched 2-to-1 by the federal matching funds.
So, I'm sorry, Vicki, did I just cut you off?
Just to say that the performance incentive was conceived of by Congress as including both the incentive payment and the federal match. Together, they made for a substantial amount of funds that states could use to improve.
So what kind of implication for states are we looking at? Tell us the dollar numbers. Tell us the implication.
Well, states will still get their incentive payments when they perform at a certain level, but they'll lose their matching funds. And what that means is that two-thirds of performance funding will be stripped out of the program. The HHS report that I referred to earlier noted that a loss of one incentive dollar translates to a $3 loss of total program funding. So the bottom line is these cuts will be devastating to child support programs. $4.9 billion will be lost over the next 10 years, and states will lose two out of every $3 of performance funding. We're hearing reports from counties that they'll lose a third of their staff, that they'll have to fold down initiatives working with low-income fathers and domestic violence victims, that the steady improvements are over once this funding goes away. Performance will begin to decline in a number of states, and more states will receive TANF penalties. I think the program will be set back years. It's heartbreaking.
sticky, are we saying goodbye performance?
I think we're saying erosion of performance. The core way, the main way that child support is collected in the country is by payroll deductions. That will continue more or less, at least in the short term. What will fall away is collections in the harder to collect cases. In other words, the poorest families, the TANF families, the families that are using public assistance, the low-income fathers who are struggling to maintain regular employment, and where the child support program has made inroads in getting them, helping them to work and to pay child support for their children. We're talking about data improvements and really that steady increase in performance that's come from a variety of initiatives. Those will fall away.
Vicki, I've got a related question here from Joe Kamnick, who's the Director of Financial Services with the Philadelphia Family Court Domestic Relations. Joe asks, and you may need to refine this question so it fits with the vocabulary you've been using. Joe asks, will accumulated 4D incentives received prior to fiscal year 2008 be grandfathered to allow 4D reimbursement on federal incentives, or will all incentives accumulated or newly received after that fiscal year be unavailable for reimbursement?
This is a question about whether the incentive payments that have been earned by a state but have not yet been spent.
Wait, can I stop you there?
Yes.
Incentive payments independent of the match or just the incentive payments period?
Well, the states receive an incentive payment based on their performance, and then they spend that money on core child support activities.
Uh-huh.
That's required by state statute that they spend them on the child support program. When they spend them, those expenditures are eligible for a match under the current law. So the states are getting these incentive payments. They're spending it on the child support program. Those expenditures are eligible for a match under the current law. So the question is, what happens when a state has earned those incentive payments, and then but before they've spent the money on the child support program.
Got it. Okay.
And I think ultimately this is an implementation question for HHS. The language isn't crystal clear in this regard, but the amendment does take effect on October 1st, 2007, and after that date, the statute will prohibit the secretary from paying matching funds on amounts spent on state plan activities with incentive payments. So the statute is written in a way that prohibits the secretary from making matching funds on child support activities that have been paid for with incentive payments. How that October 1st, 2007 date shakes out for the situation that Joe is describing is open to HHS's interpretation.
So good question, Joe. All right, Vicki. We've been talking about states. What about what the funding cut means for families?
Well, you know, it was interesting on the Hill when this provision was being debated. Many members thought that families would not be affected, that this was just merely a cost shift between the federal government and the states. What the Congressional Budget Office estimated, however, is that $8.4 billion would go uncollected in support.
Over what period of time?
Over a 10-year period.
Okay.
So $8.4 billion go uncollected over 10 years.
A big hunk of change.
It's a big hunk of change. And the families that will be hurt most are the TANF families, the ones that extra staffing, extra enforcement and program initiatives are needed to help.
So that list you were mentioning before,
that's
ones
right.
Who don't have that automated pay stub system in place already because they're not in a regular kind of job scenario.
That's right. Every time you have to go to court, every time you have to have a caseworker sit down and talk to a family, every time you're dealing with two states in an interstate case, those kinds of cases are the ones that will suffer from this cut.
Well, you mentioned the second cut as well as this big one, and that second cut is the reduction in the federal matching rate for paternity lab tests. Can you fill us in on the significance of that and what it really amounts to?
Yes. Paternity is the legal relationship between a father and child, and it's usually established in the hospital when the baby is born. Parents agree voluntarily that the child is his and the child has his name on the birth certificate. This rate to reimburse genetic tests would drop from 90% to 66%. And genetic tests are used when fathers have doubts. The tests are offered to parents when there is a doubt, and in recent years the genetic tests have been made more available so that parents can be sure that the baby has the right parents. I think this cut to the matching rate on genetic lab tests will mean that states are going to use the tests more sparingly, and they're less likely to offer low-income men the opportunity for a free genetic test if he has doubts about his paternity.
So is this yet another illustration of where the poor are getting fewer services?
I think that's right. I think states have made some real inroads in recent years to make this genetic test available to low-income men, and I think that will be more difficult for states to afford in the future.
Vicki, you were talking about a parental fee in the beginning. What is that?
The fee is imposed on families who have never received TANF assistance. It's a fee on top of a fee. In other words, families are already subject to...
A fee for what? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Families are already subject to an application fee and in some states other fees. This fee is an annual fee of $25 for each case. So if a parent has two cases involving different children, then she'll be charged a fee for each case. And the fee is retained from collected support, off the top of collected support, after the first $500 is collected. That first $500 is exempt from the fee.
And what's the purpose of the fee? Is it straight out revenue raising, or is there some other goal behind the fee?
I think there's different philosophies about user fees, but I think the reason why this fee is in the bill is revenue raising.
Let's drop back as well to the use of your term heartbreaking when you were talking about the cut in incentive match payments. For some listeners, the word might be inexplicable, I guess, because child support was always understood to be a bipartisan program. Lots of folks walked around thinking that it was bulletproof politically. In other words, bulletproof from the vagaries of party politics. Do you think that this huge cut in incentive match payments signals less support for the child support program?
I hope not. There has been strong bipartisan support for the program, as you mentioned, Jody, and in fact, real focus on both sides of the aisle in improving the program. The child support cuts were one of the top issues that members on the Hill mentioned as a concern, again, on both sides of the aisle. We found there was a fair amount of confusion and misunderstanding about how the child support program was funded and how the cuts would operate. And I think that once that funding is better understood, it will be clear to others, as it is to me, that it's one of those cuts that's both pound foolish and penny foolish. It's a program that reduces federal costs in other programs, and to cut this program means that those other costs will go up. I might mention here that Representative McDermott, who's the ranking member of the Human Resources Committee in the House, the committee with jurisdiction over the child support program, has introduced a bill along with Representative Emanuel and Levin to repeal this cut.
Well, that's a pretty fast move.
Yes, it is, and I think it expresses the concern that members have about the wisdom of this cut. We all know we live in a difficult budget environment, but this is the wrong cut and the wrong priority.
Okay, well, let's move away from heartbreaking then, because I know from staff meetings, Vicki, that on any opportunity you've had a chance to point out that there's some positive developments that we need to recognize in the arena of new assignment and distribution provisions in the child support program. Fill us in.
Well, that's right. There are a mix of requirements and options in the bill that give states the authority to pay more child support to current and former TANF families. The bill allows states to pay all collected support to families if they choose.
And what are some of the critical factoids on distribution and how that system works that those maybe who are not expert in child support really need to appreciate to understand the role distribution can play?
Well, you thought the child support financing system was complicated. Let me go to distribution.
No. Simplify.
States collect $22 billion each year in child support.
That's straightforward,
yes.
Yeah.
And most of that money goes to families. About 90% of the money collected by states goes to families. But states do withhold $2 billion to help repay welfare costs. The way this works is that when a family applies for TANF assistance, the family is required to sign over its rights to child support, both those rights to support that were owed before they go on assistance, as well as the support owed during the assistance period. This fact might come as a surprise to some in our audience, but in fact, most of the withheld support is collected for former TANF families rather than for current TANF families. But support in both for current and former TANF families is withheld and a significant amount.
Well, Vicki, let's dig a little deeper on that $2 billion that is held back every year from current and former TANF families. What's accomplished with that?
Well, the child support program was originally set up as a cost recovery mechanism for the old welfare program, AFDC, or Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And in those days, families could receive cash assistance for as long as they needed it, and child support collections were not very reliable. So the idea back then was that children would receive public support, and then states would reimburse themselves with the private support paid by non-custodial parents. At the time, policymakers thought that families viewed money as fungible, that it didn't make any difference to families and fathers whether the child received payments from the parents or payments from the government. I think we have quite a different set of assumptions nowadays, and I think the research would bear out that child support income is not like other kinds of income to the family. In fact, the research indicates that a dollar of child support income produces more positive child outcomes than a dollar from any other source. So these child support dollars, which are dollars paid by the other parent, which are parental dollars, make a big difference to families, and holding them back to repay welfare benefits is probably not the best policy use of the money.
Vicki, how do states that are holding back these monies, what do they do with it?
Well, when states hold back the money, they split it with the federal government, and they use the medical assistance reimbursement rate to share the child support collections between the federal government and states. And the significance of that is that poorer states, which get more help with medical assistance, also repay more of the collected child support to the federal government. For example, a state like Mississippi repays the federal government $77 for every $100 of child support that it collects.
There are some states, though, that pass through some of the money to families receiving TANF benefits. Isn't that right?
That's right. The money goes to at the federal level, goes to the Treasury. And at the state level, most states use the money to help pay for TANF maintenance of effort requirements. However, the state does have authority to pay some of the money or all of the money to families while they're receiving TANF. A third of states do pay at least some money, at least $50, to families while they're receiving TANF.
Well, yeah.
And the rest of that would go into the state budget.
Well, you just said while families are on TANF, they might be getting $50 in some states. What happens when those families leave TANF?
Well, the state has very little discretion in this area. What the law, what the federal law says is that most of the child support will go to families once they've left HANF. So the monthly support that comes in every month and about half or two-thirds of the back payments that are collected, all will go to families once they've left HANF. However, the state does continue to hold back a significant share of back payments that it collects through one particular way of collecting, particular collection mechanism, and that's the federal tax offset procedure. This is holding back child support from the income tax refunds of non-custodial parents that owe support.
Vicki, help drill down again. Walk us through the pre-assistance, post-TANF pass-through picture.
Well, the bill addresses all three of these areas, so let me take each one in turn.
Okay.
The current law says that when you apply for TANF assistance, you're required to turn over your rights to child support owed before you go on assistance. So if I come on to assistance with the non-custodial parent owing me $5,000, I have to turn over that right to the state. Under the bill, states would be limited to the assistance period in requiring assignments. So families that are owed child support before they apply for assistance would be able to keep that money once it's collected.
All of it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The second area is post-TANF provisions. And the current law says that families get most of it, but the state holds back support collected through a federal tax offset procedure. Under the bill, states will have the option either to pay that money to pay that money to families who have left TANF, or to keep that money as they do now. And then the third area is passing through child support to families while they're still receiving TANF. Under the current law, states have the authority to pass through any amount of money to families receiving TANF, or they don't have to pass through any of it. That doesn't change under the new bill. What does change under the new bill, though, is the cost-sharing arrangement with the federal government, because under current law, the state can decide to pass through money to current TANF families, but they have to repay the federal government its share whether or not they pass through any money. Under the bill, states that decide to pass through money to families will be able to get that federal share waived up to a set of limits.
So, Vicki, you're a state looking at this new option of passing through the support money to the family and under the new state obligation with respect to repaying the federal share. How do you weigh that as a state, whether to go ahead and pass through money to the family?
Well, I think there's a lot of things to take into account, and the accounting, the financial cost and benefits are more complicated than might first appear. There's the money that the government would be passing through to families. That's revenue that's given up by the state if they do pass through the support to families. That's one cost. On the other hand, when families get support, they tend to leave TANF faster, stay off of TANF longer, and use other kinds of public assistance less. So there's a reduced cost in these other programs to states. In addition, there may be an interaction. Research from Wisconsin indicates that when the money is passed through to families, fathers pay more support and more fathers pay support. So the collection rate goes up. That in turn may generate more incentive payments for the state. So there's quite a few different factors to take into account in looking at the financial picture here of passing through support. In addition, there are a number of policy and philosophical questions here, which is, should the state be holding back money that fathers pay to support their kids? And what's the right policy there? And what can the state afford?
Mm-hmm. Now, Vicki, when you've been talking about pass-through, you don't have to pass through all the support. You could just pass through some amount of the support. Is there any research that parses the value of passing through all of the support that a family is owed versus just pass through some amount?
There have been a series of demonstrations that have been conducted by three or four states. Wisconsin has the most developed research on the issue. Wisconsin passed through and disregarded 100% of the support collected month by month. And those two policies are quite important to look at separately. One is paying the money to the family while they're on TANF, and the other is disregarding that income in determining TANF benefits. And the Wisconsin study had a policy, it was testing a policy that had both policies. Wisconsin passed through the money, and they disregarded it in determining TANF benefits. And that research indicated that there were a number of benefits to the family and to the public in that policy. Fathers paid more support was paid by fathers. The fathers were more willing to establish paternity faster. There was less underground employment by low-income fathers. They were less likely to work underground and more likely to work in a regular job. And then there were a number of side benefits that showed up in certain subgroups of families. Some families where support was coming in every month, there was less violence. There was more satisfaction with child care. There were better outcomes for children and education and health. These are all hints of findings in subgroups in that research, but they all together indicate a policy that works well for families. Let me add one more thing, which is that in Wisconsin, the cost to the state was zero of passing through and disregarding the support. And the reason for that is that increased collections and decreased public assistance use offset the cost of giving up the revenues and paying the support to families.
Vicki, I want to pick up on one of the things you were just saying. You were talking about for some families where when the money was coming in every month. If given that child support is a significant source of income for some families, this continuity of payment, the stability of payment, is a critical issue. If you get it, but it's only 2 months out of 12 in a given year, that's one thing. But if you get it 12 months a year, that's another. How reliable are child support payments?
They're getting more reliable over time, and one of the concerns, of course, we have with the budget cut is that the support will become less reliable. But research that was conducted and examined by a set of researchers found that child support, when it's paid, is more reliable than not. In other words, most poor families do not get child support. 36% of families, according to the Urban Institute, are getting child support. That means the majority of families are not getting child support. But when they are getting child support, that support is reliable in the majority of cases. Two-thirds of families are getting steady support month after month for at least 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump to a question that's actually come in from a listener, which is, how do the policies affect non-custodial parents, typically the fathers?
The pass-through and distribution provisions?
Yes.
Think about it. A father is told to support his children. It could be a non-custodial mother also, but the majority of fathers in the child support program are fathers, about 90%. He may have limited education and job opportunities himself. He may have trouble holding a job for a variety of reasons. And he knows that as soon as he starts a job in the regular economy, child support is going to be withheld from his paycheck. And because of the way orders are set, poor fathers pay a larger percentage of their paycheck for child support than better off fathers. So he knows that he's going to start this job. He's going to turn over a lot of money for child support out of his paycheck. He also knows that money is not going to go to his children. He knows the government is going to keep it. And so he knows if he goes to work, he's going to be giving up his paycheck to the government. That is a discouraging factor for low-income fathers. Many low-income fathers avoid the formal job altogether and work in informal employment or underground activities. In part, the research shows, to avoid child support enforcement. And one of the key things that the research shows over and over again in a number of studies is that fathers say they are willing to support their children, but they are not willing to turn this money over to the government.
So are there things that states could be doing at this point in time to work with these non-custodial parents to overcome some of these issues?
Well, I think for states that are interested in working with low-income fathers, helping them to maintain employment and support their kids, I think one policy front and center that needs to be dealt with is this distribution policy, because in my experience and the experience of a number of practitioners running programs for low-income fathers, they are less willing to participate in job training, less willing to participate in fatherhood programming, and less willing to work in a regular steady job if that money is being diverted by the state and kept by the state as revenues. These are low-income fathers who are having trouble getting and maintaining a job as it is. And when you add that child support factor of having the money go to the government instead of their children, it is a discouraging thing.
But taken as a total package, the other changes in the bill and so on, can states really afford to zero in on these distribution opportunities?
I think that the distribution provisions are something that states should take a second look at. A second look at.
Okay.
I mean, the cuts to the child support program are disappointing in this regard too. That states have been poised to consider whether to implement the distribution options, and now with these deep funding cuts, they don't see how they're going to be able to afford them in the near term. And what I would say is that the cost-benefit analysis of implementing the distribution provisions is more complicated than it looks on the surface, as we were talking about earlier, and that states may find that the benefits outweigh the costs, even with their reduced financial situation.
Sort of an over time picture rather than just a first year kind of look-see?
That's right. It does require a longer view, and that's hard in a budgeting environment. But the payoffs in terms of reduced public assistance use, increased collections, increased incentive payments, and increased simplification of the program computer and training and staffing, making the program make sense for parents, has a real fiscal benefit attached to it.
Well, Vicki, let's say we've got some folks from child support agencies around the country listening in, and they do want to take a look at the long-term implications. Is there anybody who's sort of developed a formula for that kind of budget analysis, realizing that everybody's sort of constrained by an annual budget process in most states and so forth, but if someone were able to pitch a longer-term view, has anybody got a sort of template procedure for making this analysis?
I think we're in the process of trying to develop that. A number of research groups are beginning to take a look at that to try to assist states in analyzing the budget consequences of implementing distribution provisions.
Okay, Doug. We've touched on distribution. We've touched on the massive cut in federal match for incentive payments. You also mentioned at the beginning, though, that there are a set of other program changes. So let's drop to those. What are some of the key ones, and would you let us know your take on whether or not they're a plus or a minus?
Sure. There are a set of enforcement and program changes, and by and large, I think the changes are viewed as a good thing, but they do have a price tag attached to them. States will need to implement them. They'll need to reprogram their computer, and that incentive match used to be available for doing some of that programming. So programs are planning on implementation costs. Let me just run through the list and
okay.
then focus on some key provisions that will directly affect families.
Okay.
There is a new requirement that states review the orders of TANF families on a 3-year cycle.
And what is it now?
It's at state discretion or if a parent requests a review.
Okay.
There are new medical support establishment and enforcement provisions, and we can talk about that a bit.
Okay.
There is a reduced trigger to deny passports when a non-custodial parent who owes child support wants to apply for a passport for international travel. One of the things that the State Department does is check to see whether the non-custodial parent owes child support. That level used to be $5,000 under the bill. The trigger is now $2,500 if a non-custodial parent owes $2,500 or more in child support, his passport application will be denied. There is expanded opportunity for children who are owed child support arrears once they reach the age of 18 to get those arrears collected through that federal tax offset procedure that I was describing to get the child support withheld from the non-custodial parents' tax refunds. There are some options related to how the states use their computer programming in interstate cases, and there are some new federal opportunities to match insurance data to try to find insurance settlements and judgments that could be applied to child support.
That's a list.
It is a list.
Let's backtrack a bit. Did you mention, I think earlier you were talking about a provision related to adjusting TANF orders?
That's
themselves,
right.
And the ability to update those and so forth. So when you update orders, doesn't that mean that the child will see more income as a result?
Not necessarily. Child support orders are set according to a state numeric guideline. So if there's a formula and when the non-custodial parents and the custodial parents are income are looked at and different costs of raising children are looked at, the order gets set, you know, based on those factors. Many times for low-income men, for men who are not steadily working, who have trouble keeping a job on a steady basis, the support order is set too high. It's set higher than the non-custodial parent's ability to pay, and that's really the watchword of child support guidelines. The orders are supposed to be set on the non-custodial parent's ability to pay. When the non-custodial parent fails to show up for court or doesn't have steady income, sometimes the support orders are based on assumed income, income that hasn't been proven, but income that assumes that he's working full-time with a minimum wage or even median wage job.
This is in the absence of data from the father?
That's in the absence of data from the computer or
from the computer.
Father. Right, right. So when there's a vacuum of information, these orders get set. And there are a lot of orders set based on assumed income for low-income fathers. And sometimes those orders are wildly out of, you know, inaccurate compared to what he actually is and can be making. So the review and adjustment process takes another look at the income of both parents and what the children's needs are. And if the review suggests that the order is out of whack, we'll adjust that order. Sometimes the order goes up if there is more income on the table than when the order was originally set. Sometimes the order can go down if the non-custodial parent's income, in fact, is lower than what was assumed at the time the order was first set. I think that this provision of requiring states to review the orders every 3 years of TANF families means that there'll be some orders that go up and some that go down.
And what is the number one guidance you would give states as they think through this new requirement on review and adjustment over every 3 years for TANF recipients? Is there some big issue to keep in mind, an eye on the prize kind of scenario?
Well, I do think that this is a this periodic review is not going to catch every TANF order, every order held by a TANF family, because families are moving on and off of TANF often far more quickly than the 3 year cycle. But at the same time, I do think it's an opportunity for states to set up the review process so that they can get the order right, so that they can take a second look at the orders and make sure that as families leave TANF, the order is accurate, that the non-custodial parent can pay it, that the custodial family is getting all of the support that they deserve, and the order is you know, put in place the right way as families leave.
Sounds like a plus. You mentioned earlier medical support provisions. Let's get into that now. First, again, a definition of medical support, and then what the new provisions do.
Well, in the past, states were only required to look at the non-custodial parent for private health care coverage. And states are required to include health care coverage as a part of the child support order. So they're looking at the income of the non-custodial parent. They're also looking at the health care coverage that the non-custodial parent could bring to the table. And they're including both of those provisions, the cash support and the medical support, in an order. And what that's meant in the past is that even if the custodial parent has better coverage, a better plan at a more affordable cost in her own community, that option was not considered in establishing the support order. The courts have been looking only to the non-custodial parent.
And they were not allowed to consider, let's say, the custodial is a mom and she has really nifty coverage. They couldn't weigh that factor?
That's right.
Okay.
It was an obligation that the courts looked to the non-custodial parent to provide.
Okay.
Under the new law, states will be able to look to both parents to see which one has the most adequate, affordable, and accessible health care coverage. And this is an important change that can open up private coverage to children when the custodial parent has a health plan.
And when, as we all know, private coverage is decreasing.
That's right.
For so many workers.
That's right. You know, while this provision allows the court or the agency, child support agency, to put all the health care options on the table with respect to private coverage, it doesn't address the problem that most low-income, low-wage parents, mother or father, are not getting health insurance through their jobs. But for those that do get health insurance through the jobs, it opens up the possibility to look at the best plan for the children.
We have a question here from Tira Lindquist, who's with the Economic Justice Project, the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which is a really interesting angle on this whole question of medical support. And I'm going to read her question to you. Quote, I'm particularly concerned about the increased emphasis on medical child support obligations and the potential for increased risk and harm to victims of domestic violence that might result. In Washington State, we don't currently have a very refined process for screening for domestic violence for parents seeking Medicaid only, that is, folks who are not on TANF but are receiving Medicaid only. And now I continue the quote, and I don't think domestic violence survivors generally understand the support enforcement involvement, nor are they helped to assess their danger related to the state contacting the non-custodial parent. Is domestic violence addressed at all in these new provisions?
No, Tira's right, and they're not addressed in these provisions. There are always concerns about pursuing either cash support or medical support when domestic violence is an issue. Research shows that the large majority of domestic violence victims want to pursue child support, but only if they can do so safely and confidentially, and this is another layer that can increase risk when domestic violence is involved. States have become more sensitive to the domestic violence issues in recent years in the child support program and in TANF, but there still is a lot to be done, and a particular issue in this area where families are coming through the Medicaid door. I think most of the
When you say the Medicaid door, what do you mean by that?
Families who are not getting TANF,
right,
but who are receiving Medicaid,
right,
or who are not receiving any public assistance at all and are coming into the program as voluntary applicants. The focus on screening for domestic violence has been largely in TANF cases, looking to the family violence option and setting up screening protocols and services through the TANF program. And that's been an important choice for states to make since a significant number of families receiving TANF do have domestic violence risks. But the problem is that these other families that are coming to the child support program, not through TANF, but through the Medicaid program or through another route, and those families are not being picked up through the TANF screening.
Mm. A different hot-button topic, Vicki, is visitation and access. Does this bill make changes in those arenas?
Not this bill. There was an increase in access and visitation funds proposed in pending TANF bills, and the President's 2007 budget also proposes increased funding.
That's the pending budget bill, the new one?
Right, right. And one of the proposals is to increase access and visitation funding. But the budget bill doesn't have a provision in it. There are a number of initiatives that focus on non-custodial parents and increasing contact between parents and children that do raise this domestic violence concern that we have. There's, even though the budget bill doesn't have more access and visitation funds, it does include new funding to fund marriage and fatherhood initiatives, and there also is pending legislation called the Second Chance Act, which would try to help ex-offenders successfully re-enter the community, and reunite with their families, and include some specific child support priorities in that bill. All of these initiatives call for or underscore the need for enhanced domestic violence procedures in the child support program. The more we try to bring fathers and children together and connect them through the child support program, the more domestic violence becomes an issue and the more screening and services we ought to be having to address that.
Vicki, in closing, some words of wisdom for listeners in our audience today who are not child support administrators or managers or experts. What would you say to listeners who know something about child support but mostly are focused on low-income families and policies that can help those low-income families? To put all this information you've given us today into context for efforts related to low-income families in 2006 and beyond, what are the implications of all of these changes in terms of what they ought to do as a first or a second step, taking into account these changes? What kinds of policies should they recognize and work on, in your view?
First of all, I think it's critical that advocates for low-income families put the child support program on the radar screen, develop relationships with the child support administrators and with legislatures around the child support issues, and include child support as one of the top issues that advocates are pressing for. 85% of poverty-level single-parent families in this country participate in the child support program. It has a huge impact on both parents, and the area is calls out for increased advocacy to improve policies in this area. The child support programs have really made a number of changes in the last few years that not only improve program performance, but start to put into effect a number of the services and protocols that low-income families need to interact effectively with the child support system. These initiatives and protocols are at risk because of the budget cut. And now more than any other time, it's critical that advocates step up to the plate and really focus on this program and the advocacy needs. I would say advocating for to maintain funding for the program is critically important at the state level. Advocating for distribution reforms, keeping in mind that child support programs and TANF programs are taking serious hits to their budgets. I would say distribution reforms are at the top of the list. Working with the set of policy changes to set more realistic orders for low-income parents is vitally important. And developing those links between the child support program and employment and prisoner reentry programs, as well as domestic violence programs and protections. These are all fertile areas for child support advocacy.
Thank you, Vicki. And I want to let the audience know that if you're not already registered for tomorrow's audio conference on child welfare, my guests will be Rutledge Hudson of the Center for Law and Social Policy, and Dave Burns, who's the director of Arizona's Department of Employment Security. I also encourage you, if you're not the right person in your organization to participate in the audio conference, if you could just pass along the word to those who really ought to tune in. Again, my thanks to you, Vicki Turetsky, for joining me today. And
thank
I'll see you,
Jody,
down the hall in a minute. And to everybody else, I hope we all see you tomorrow. Thank you very, very much. Bye-bye.